Which will be seen this evening, will be screened this evening in the official section. We've got Juan Antonio Bayona, the director of the film. Belén Atienza, producer. Paolo Basile, CEO of Mediaset Spain. Dislen Bagua, CEO of Telecinco Spain. And also Patrick Mess, the author of the novel and screenplay writer of the film. Hi, good morning. Above all, congratulations, Jota, for making everyone in San Sebastian use a lot of Kleenex to dry their eyes. No, that was a joke, no. It really made it to, it hit me in the bottom of my heart, really, the film. I want to talk to you about a couple of things of the film that don't appear. First of all, the music. It's quite clear that Fernando Velázquez and you make a perfect tandem, and you can see the films through the Fernando's music, really. It happened with The Impossible and The Orphanage, and this film's the same. Fernando's music will travels with us in our car. It's the same. What was it like to work with Fernando? And the next question is, there's a member of your crew that's not here, which is Sergio Sanchez, the scriptwriter. We've got Patrick, the writer of the novel, who has transmitted the novel and screenplayed it very well. What was it like working with Patrick as well? Okay. Well, thank you very much. With Fernando Velázquez, we've done three films and a couple of other collaborations in short films. In that film, we wanted to, our work was not what music was going to be heard, but where it wasn't going to be heard, because what was most interesting in this film were the silences, and that is to say the challenge of a story whose base was quite dramatic in itself and very emotional. To a certain extent, we had to measure that in order to give the right dimension to the film. And for me, what I'm more proud of is the work that we did of those silences in the films. There are three or four moments that are very dramatic in the film where there's no music in the background, and that's the most beautiful part of the film, I believe, and most emotional. Having said this, Fernando's music score was quite contained, very difficult to The Impossible, for example, because there was a lot of much more excitement, and when people met themselves after the tsunami. Here, everything had to be much more contained. It has a lot of different tones in this film, because the film has a lot of different tones, and that's where the challenge lies. The soundtrack, we were very fortunate. We recorded here in San Sebastian with the Basque Symphony Orchestra and the Orfeon Donostiarra, which is a choir, and it was great to listen to them. And the other question is, as regards to the scriptwriter, well, I think that the collaboration with Patrick was very good from the outset, because Patrick understood in the same way that he'd made Siobhan's story, because this novel is based upon an idea by Siobhan Dow, and that he was in charge of writing it, and he understood that I should tell my story. I like the film because it's the analogy that exists between Connor's journey and my director's journey. To tell a story is all to seek for the truth and to express the truth. And Patrick understood that was the way we had to confront it, to write a novel thought about by another person. And my way of directing the film is based upon somebody else's text. Okay? Congratulations for the film. My question is, in a book, and when there are many, many different layers, because the characters have many different layers, it's very deep. How could you pick that up, and how did you work upon all those different levels and layers? Well, it's very difficult to address a story with so many different layers. The truth is, one can't set up or draw a map And I don't think it's a good idea. I think the most interesting thing is, to a certain extent, to keep that instinctive side of things that makes you go ahead without knowing what it is. It's almost intuitive, and try to answer it on that journey. But I think the secret, and I refer to what I was talking about, Connor, it's trying to find the truth. In every scene, every moment on set, basically what I tried to do was to, everything that happened in front of the camera, for it to look like truth, for it to be true, to have that point that makes you see that you're doing a great job and you're doing it right. And then in the editing room, for example, we introduced the art side of things that doesn't form part of the novel, and it added another layer to it, a story which already had a lot of different subject matter and layers, some of them very important, like, for example, the cancer or bullying, for example. And if we wouldn't have done the exercise of finding the right architecture and different levels of fantasy and reality, the challenge in the film was truly to find the right architecture in the editing room.
Hola, buenos días.
Hi, good morning. I'd like to ask about the work with Liam Neeson. They'll say, how did you get in touch with him, and how did you treat and his voice, for example, and digitalizing all the work? I'm not too sure whether it's digitalized or whatever you do to the voice. And then on the other side, how many times could you hear in the shoot something like, Liam, you're a monster. You're a great monster because of your voice. How many times did you hear that on in the shoot? Well, okay, quite fortunately in the film, we had Sigourney Weaver and Toby Kebbell, who are experts in motion capture because they've had their experience, especially Toby Kebbell, whose filmography has been carried out with the technology. Half his career has been done with this type of technology. But it's quite curious because all of a sudden you find Liam Neeson in a ridiculous pajama wearing on set without any external props or anything. And I think Sigourney gave a great analogy. It's like working in theater when you're rehearsing. You turn up on set and it seems you were doing something else because there was nothing in the, no decorations or anything. So therefore, it was like a rehearsal. So therefore, that's really creative on the one hand, but on the other hand, we had a character who, if he took another step, he would get out, he would move outside the set, if you can, because of a big, there wasn't so much freedom. It was a challenge that we had to be quite clearly measured, because any extra movement became gigantic on set. So therefore, it was quite good that we shot at the beginning everything, which is the motion capture, for a couple of weeks. This enabled us to make the complete film with Lewis McGowan and Liam Neeson, Lewis McDowell and Liam Neeson together. It was a great challenge for me and the young kid, and very good for Liam to be able to do the film in front of the child. And then on set, we had a real replication of the monster, and the child acted in front of him with the voice of Nia in the background. The voices, we touched it very little because Liam's voice is quite impressive. One of the reasons that we chose him was precisely because his voice, he'd already done things with his voice, and not only the quality of his voice, but the way he interprets it, that is to say, it was extraordinary. That is to say, when I saw the first story, when he said, or heard the first story, it was extraordinary to listen to his voice. How he vocally portrays this, it was great, spectacular. We didn't touch it very much, that is to say. The objective was for the film to be anchored basically in reality. Even the monster is quite simple and responds to a very pure idea of a dark figure of a man, really. Yes, congratulations. I'm still quite moved after seeing the film and thinking about the film, that it works with very well, well lubricated machinery, that is to say, it works very well. And I want to congratulate everyone involved. The dream side of things is very interesting because you say that you've got to look into your unconscious, and then there are a few nods that you make that were excellent. Masterly done. The grandfather, the absent character, is in a photo at the beginning and at the end. And that is to say, when the monster tells the child, I'm going to be here with you, that is to say, the epilogue is also excellent. That is to say, when he seizes the illustrations of these mothers left behind in the painting book, and the audience knows that they are the stories that he didn't remember, but that the stories of the tree were there in that book. And I thought that was marvelous. The film has an enormous amount of stories, and it's a great way of teaching people how to tell stories. I can't say anything else. Now keep going. You're blowing me away. This is fantastic. Okay, the role of the grandfather, the hidden grandfather that's mentioned a couple of times, and then the fact that there aren't any bad or good, bad guys and good guys, that the father's left, and he tells him that's okay, that's the prince, and then the witch who was a very bad witch, who was the grandmother, but then it's as if the mother had been forewarning or about to tell, can I shut up now, can I go, do you want me to keep blowing you up? Otherwise, I'll invite you a drink later on if you think, if that's okay. Wasn't a question, what was all that about? Yes. To answer your remark, there was an intention for the film to have many different layers from the audience perspective, and the fact of attending that question, which is an underlying question and which is never responded, that is to say, when you leave those gaps so that the audience can fill in the film. At the same time, it's a film that means to be accessible. It was a very important for me that at a given moment that everything in society has to be black or white, doesn't it? But it was important for me to tell a story which is accessible for the audience, that we tell that it's told that's black and white, but to understand that sometimes can be black and white at the same time, and that's a complex discourse, and that was my intention, was to transmit this. And that you as a director, you try to, on the one hand, be accessible and be mysterious at the same time. So the objective is for the audience to walk home, apart from the emotional side of things. The emotion at the end of the day is balsamic, really, because otherwise it would be a very tough film. Emotion is what you want you to take home with you. Like, for example, it's not like MasterChef, for example. Emotions are not that important, if you catch what I'm saying, because you watch MasterChef and get emotional. But your state after seeing the film and how you go home, what you take with you, thinking about the film, all the characters in the film have to be a reflection of yourself, really. I can't hear this gentleman now without the microphone. Hi, good morning. I'd like to ask you, Jota, because we've got Saguni with the river with you. Why her? I understand you wanted her to work with you, but in the film, but what aspects of her personality and of her work interested you? And what was the spark that arose between what's the professional complicity that existed there? Saguni, apart from being, as you say, it's obvious the answer. Why do you want to work with Saguni Weaver? That's obvious. Well, I'd also seen, after Sitges Film Festival, she was in Snow White. She was the witch. And to a certain extent, we were looking at for the witch of Snow White, a witch who's got another element to her, because she ends up being, I don't want to spoil it, but to being the person who takes care of the little boy. But I think that there's something quite clear in Saguni which makes her different to other women, warriors, that is to say, that you always see latently in her, you always see an emotion, you always see a heart and a certain sensitivity, which is quite obvious from the first day we met, because we met and she started to talk to me about the story, and it was quite exciting for me, quite moving. And all of those different layers that you see through her filmography, for example, she's got everything. She's done comedy, sci-fi films. She's got dramatic roles and portrayals like Gorillas in the Mist or The Death and the Maid, for example. She's got so many films that I went to her caravan to ask her many things about how she did this film and how did Polanski do this and how did someone, and she'd tell me her stories, and we had a great time at that level, and that's always makes you feel much more relaxed on set. But as you said, it's quite obvious why I wanted to work with Saguni. And the spark, well, the spark arises when you see a really, really good job done, and she's a perfectionist. She's very perfectionist. I recall the gesture of the painting, the nails, she likes details of her nails being painted, for example, little details like that. Any object on set, any prop, at that level of perfectionism that she, and that linked to her being very genuine, because she was very moved when she read the story. So that was a perfect combination, I believe. Hi, good morning. I would like to ask you about how you conceived all of the animation in the film. I thought that was quite impressive, by the way, and it reminded me of it. The tone is completely different, because it's not the first time that you work with real images and animation. The film Mis Vacaciones, My Vacation, I think he said. Okay. When I read the book and I see the stories, my first impression is I don't want to see actors doing the story. When I start to think about it, I realize for Connor, those characters are more ideas than characters. The story had sufficient layers in order to put any more actors in the middle. So therefore, it occurred to me to animate this. I have a friend who's an illustrator. He never draws faces. When you don't draw a face, you project that face onto whoever's looking at it. We wanted to do animation without any faces. But throughout the story, the stories and the fantasy reveal Connor, the more real life side of life. And therefore, the animations, as you say, are become much more realistic. It starts with an animation which is a bit more flat with watercolors, and it ends up being something like a slow-mo, and then the character gets right inside. So therefore, that idea of how stories become much more realistic, and he gets involved and he forms part of it, he gets inside it. And we worked with marvelous people, Angeles, for example, Barcelona. I had met them many years ago and I wanted to work with them for quite a while. Now, when the idea of telling the stories with animation, well, we got in touch with them straight away. Hi. A question for Patrick. I would like to know, what was it like to create, as of Siobhan's idea, how did you do that process starting from scratch, really? I know, and also for Jota and Saguni and yourself, Connor O'Malley is afraid to confess the truth at the end. Do you have any truth that you are afraid of confessing as well?
The translator is Australian, so it's really interesting to listen to Australian accent. I'm running. You don't have to translate. That's okay. It's cool though. I like it. I like it. It's distracting. The story behind the book. It's pronounced Siobhan. It's an Irish name. Siobhan Dowd was a terrific writer of teen fiction, and she wrote four really, really great novels. And A Monster Calls was going to be her fifth novel. And she had, she was ready to go. She had a beginning and a structural idea, but she wrote all of those books knowing that she had terminal cancer, and she knew she was going to die, so she tried to write them as quickly as possible. But she died just a little faster than she thought. She thought she would have time to write A Monster Calls. And so at the time, we shared an editor at my publisher, and my editor brought it to me and said, would you consider taking this idea and turning it into a book? And my first reaction was probably not, because I worry you can't write a memorial. You can't write, it has to be a story, because that's what Siobhan Dowd would have done. But her idea, it was sort of an opening chapter, a few characters, and the idea of this tree that would speak and tell these stories. And though it was small, it was so rich that I immediately started getting other ideas. And the very, very first idea I had was, in fact, the grandmother's sitting room, where Connor comes out of maybe a dream or a vision to discover he's destroyed all of the antiques in his grandmother's sitting room, which to me is the fulcrum of the story and the fulcrum of the film. It's where we see all of his real rage at not being able to say the truth, as you say. And that, to me, is what... that's the trap of any young person, which is he's old enough to be told some things, but not old enough to be told everything, except, of course, he figures it out. He understands exactly what's going on, but no one will confirm it, so he has no one to talk to about it. And to me, that's really what the story is about, to uncovering the ugly truth, that there's a contradiction there, that he can't stand the pain of it, but he's also going to lose her. So how do you reconcile the two things? And I think, to me, that is the moment where we become adults. I think that's the adult moment where you realize that you are a complex individual and can believe contradictory things, and you have to learn to live with believing those contradictory things. And so for me, for the grandma was a really important character for me, because I thought Connor sees her purely as villain. She is purely the Wicked Witch, she's the evil stepmother. But I thought we will understand more than he does, that she has lost her husband and she's about to lose her daughter. And what on earth must that, what effect must that have on a person? And so it was really, really important to me to, we see her from the beginning in a certain way, and then she slowly starts to unpack, and we understand that she might be difficult, but that doesn't mean bad. And Connor understanding the complexity of her is a huge step, again, into growing up. And Sigourney, we talked about this last night actually, is perfect for this, because the persona of Sigourney is so strong and so powerful, and that's really useful because you can start there, and then you can start to sneak underneath it and subvert it, and it can become something really surprising and really beautiful. So it was a really perfect combination for me. That's a really long answer. Thank you for listening.
Tenemos tiempo para una última pregunta.
Time for one last question. Hi, congratulations for the film, and congratulations, for Sigourney, for the Donostia Award. My question is for Sigourney Weaver, the actress. I'd like to know your opinion about human tragedy of the refugees at the door of Europe. To finish, what do we have to do to finish? To come to, for this to come to an end, do we need a monster there in order to solve that problem? What can you tell us about that?
I think there we have a good supply of monsters already. I think it you know, I'm in the U.S. of course. We have not taken any, for instance, Syrian refugees, which is something I don't understand. I think. It's been very moving to me to see different countries in Europe grappling with this, what I think will become a fact of our modern life, which is huge groups of people moving away from drought and from the chaos that sometimes can happen in war, et cetera. I think we all have to help each other to figure out how to take care of these people. I can't think of anything more frightening, frankly, than being a mother with a family and not having a home, a country, a house, living in these camps, if you're lucky, with no country wanting me. It's, to me, unbearable. I don't have any answers, but I do think we need to all work together, because it's something that I think will increase. And I hope that with President Clinton, unlike, won't even say it, that we will develop a more compassionate attitude. I was working in Canada, and I think 25,000 different Syrians arrived, and they were taken into the homes of various Canadian families. And I wish that we were doing that too.
Okay, thank you very much. Gracias a todos.
Thank you very much.